publish, so he unbosomed himself in a series of memoranda to Elihu Root. He wanted the record to show that Miles had once approached him in an utterly fatuous attempt to run against William McKinley. To my mind, his actions can bear only the construction that his desire is purely to gratify his selfish ambition, his vanity, or his spite. The memos were classified confidential, private, and personal. Root filed them, knowing such strictures, in Roosevelt's parlance, usually meant hold for publication. He had hardly done so, indeed, before Congress asked for documents relating to Miles's insinuations, and the President sanctioned their release. Root wrote separately to Henry Cabot Lodge, whose Senate Committee on the Philippines was considering a transition from military to civil government in the archipelago. He acknowledged 44 cases of documented cruelty, of which 39 had already resulted in convictions under the military justice system. Aside from these isolated lapses, the war in the Philippines has been conducted by the American Army with self-restraint and with humanity never surpassed, if ever equaled, in any conflict. Root's words masked embarrassment, for he knew that Miles had gotten hold of a secret report that indicated otherwise. It came from the military governor of Tayabas, Major Cornelius Gardner, and described how the barrios of that once peaceful province had been brutalized by American soldiers. Gardner spoke of deep hatred toward us, and, more disturbingly, of reciprocal prejudice against the Filipinos. Almost without exception, soldiers, and also many officers, refer to the natives in their presence as niggers, and the natives are beginning to understand what nigger means. So damning was the Gardner report that Governor William Howard Taft had suppressed it for 7 weeks, on the querulous ground that it might be biased. Root was guilty of delay himself, having sent his copy back to Manila by slow sea mail for verification. He had done so, however, for sensibly strategic reasons. The insurrection was in fact almost over, and a final surrender by holdout guerrillas was expected within weeks. The honor of American arms, of Republican foreign policy, demanded a clean, decisive victory. General Miles moved adroitly during the next few weeks. He made no attempt to leak the Gardner report beyond letting Democrats in Congress know it existed. They began to press for its publication. Meanwhile, he set about sabotaging another aspect of administration policy. Tall and dignified in his coruscating uniform, he dominated the Senate Committee on Military Affairs hearings on the Army Bill. This measure, the most profound review of American military organization in more than a century, was the fruit of several years' hard labor by Elihu Root. It sought to make line and staff officers interchangeable, to promote by merit rather than seniority, and to create a general staff answerable to the Secretary of War. More to the point, it also sought to abolish the system whereby Root administered and Miles commanded the Army on a co-equal basis. Root wanted a vertical structure that sent power down from himself to a chief of staff. The office of commanding general would therefore be abolished. Root counted on the approval of the American people in view of their ingrained tendency to insist upon civilian control of the military arm. Miles reminded the Senate Committee that the American people also had a prejudice against authoritarianism. He glittered to great effect while portraying Roosevelt and Root as executive upstarts who wished to create a monarcho-militarist court, like that of the Kaiser in Germany. The concept of a general staff was utterly subversive to the interests of the military establishment. Miles hitched back his epaulets and declared in martyred tones that he would rather resign than submit to despotism from the White House. Senator Joseph Hawley, the chairman of the committee, was himself a retired major general. He praised Miles's testimony as unanswerable and allowed that the Army Bill, as presently drafted, would receive no further consideration. "General Miles wins," the Washington Post blazed, while Watterson congratulated the American people on escaping an act to make the President of the United States a military dictator. Root's expressionless calm in the face of this defeat boded ill for Miles. Few doubted that the commanding general would be dismissed for insubordination. Yet day after day went by with no action by the White House. March gave way to April. Miles and Root continued to work in their opposing suites in the War Department, striding past each other in contemptuous silence. Roosevelt was struggling with contrary impulses of rage and caution. Miles was a perfect curse, but his huge popularity, both inside and outside Congress, could not be ignored. To dismiss him now might sabotage the Army bill forever, and set Miles up as a sentimental favorite for the Democratic presidential nomination. Perhaps, after all, he should be allowed to visit the Philippines. The thought of Miles having to endure a 49-day ocean voyage was pleasing, and with luck his visit would coincide with the mosquito season. But what atrocities might he uncover there, to the detriment of Roosevelt's own candidacy in 1904? "It is getting to be a case," the president complained, "of whether I can longer permit great damage to the army for the sake of avoiding trouble to myself." Lodge's Committee on the Philippines reluctantly published the Gardner Report on 11 April. It caused instant national outrage. 2 days later, the Anti-Imperialist League released the even more shocking confession of a Major C.M. Waller on trial for genocide in Samar. Question: had you any orders from General Jacob H. Smith to kill and burn? If so, state all that he said. Answer: I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and the more you burn, the better you will please me. Not once only, but several times. Question: did you ever ask General Smith whom he wished you to kill? Answer: yes, he said he wanted all persons killed who were capable of bearing arms, and I asked if he would define the age limit. Question: what did General Smith say? Answer: 10 years. Waller also quoted a written order from the general: the interior of Samar must be made a howling wilderness. No sooner had the phrases kill and burn and howling wilderness registered on the American conscience than a third, water cure, came out of the committee hearings. Witness after witness testified to widespread use by American soldiers of this traditional torture developed by Spanish priests as a means of instilling reverence for the Holy Ghost. A man is thrown down on his back, and three or four men sit on his arms and legs and hold him down, and either a gun barrel or a rifle barrel or a carbine barrel or a stick as big as a belaying pin is simply thrust into his jaws. And then water is poured onto his face, down his throat and nose, until the man gives some sign of giving in or becomes unconscious. His suffering must be that of a man who is drowning, but who cannot drown. Other reports spoke of natives being flogged, toasted, strung up by their thumbs, and tattooed facially for identification. Amid mounting cries of revulsion, the president swung into action. He met with his cabinet on 15 April and demanded a full briefing on the Philippine situation. Root said defensively that one officer accused of water torture had been ordered to report for trial. Roosevelt was not satisfied. His entire insular policy was in danger, not to mention his reputation for decent governance. He directed Root to flash a cable to Major General Adna Chaffee, commander of the Philippines Army. "The President desires to know in the fullest and most circumstantial manner all the facts. For the very reason that the President intends to back up the Army in the heartiest fashion in every lawful and legitimate method of doing its work, he also intends to see that the most vigorous care is exercised to detect and prevent any cruelty or brutality, and that men who are guilty thereof are punished. Great as the provocation has been in dealing with foes who habitually resort to treachery, murder, and torture against our men, nothing can justify or will be held to justify the use of torture or inhuman conduct of any kind on the part of the American Army." Roosevelt also ordered the court-martial of General Smith, under conditions which will give me the right of review. These gestures, which coincided with the surrender of Miguel Malvar, the last uncaptured Filipino guerrilla leader, relieved pressure on the White House, if not the War Department. Tired and depressed, the secretary sailed for a working vacation in Cuba. Calls for Root's resignation followed him across the water. When General Smith admitted, on 25 April, to having authorized the slaughter of Filipino boys, even loyal Republicans were revolted. "It is almost incredible," the Philadelphia Press commented, "that an American officer of any rank could have issued an order so shameful, inhuman, and barbarous." Root was accused of a cover-up, or at least a reluctance to prosecute army cruelty. "If we are to benevolently assimilate Filipinos by such methods," remarked the New Orleans Times Democrat, "we should frankly so state and drop our canting hypocrisy about having to wage war on these people for their own betterment." Roosevelt again made no effort to help his beleaguered secretary. Relations between them had been strained since the Northern Securities suit. Root's mood was not improved by his awareness that the president had known at least the essence of General Smith's murderous policies for 4 months. Their tacit understanding had been that commanders such as Smith should be allowed to end the war quickly, with not too many questions asked. Like all conservatives, Root disliked being called a reactionary. He sought to build policy on good and essential truths, historically tested. One such truth was that democracy had not succeeded in Asia, except after a fashion among the sophisticated Japanese. Most Filipinos were but little advanced from pure savagery. For every case of water torture the anti-imperialists might name, he could cite instances where American boys had been mutilated and burned alive, sometimes after honoring a white flag. One could no more trust than treat with the insurrectos. They were Chinese in their obtuseness. Miguel Malvar's surrender document stated that all his people wanted was independence under a protectorate. This pathetic desire to be both liberated and looked after suggested that Kipling had been right about the white man's burden. America had a moral duty toward her new-caught sullen peoples, half-devil and half-child. They had been taught the harsh discipline of war and must now adapt to the milder discipline of civil government. In formulating his attitude toward Filipinos, Root relied on the dispatches of William Howard Taft. The governor was a convert to the moral mandate philosophy. When first sent to the archipelago in 1900, he had been an anti-imperialist. Massive, patient, capable, radiating goodwill, he had both charmed and reassured the enemy, whom he embraced collectively as our little brown brother. American soldiers in the field sang over their campfires, "He may be a brother of Big Bill Taft, but he ain't no brother of mine." Taft had succeeded so well in the Philippines as diplomat and executive that his conversion to imperialism passed almost unnoticed. Only recipients of his classified dispatches understood how deeply he despised the people he governed. "Filipinos," Taft wrote, "were the greatest liars it has ever been my fortune to meet. The educated minority were ambitious as Satan and quite as unscrupulous. The rest, some 6.5 million peasants and jungle tribesmen, were inferior to the most ignorant Negro and utterly unfit for self-government. They need the training of 50 or 100 years before they shall even realize what Anglo-Saxon liberty is." These sentiments, while not uncommon, had force coming from a man widely believed to be of presidential caliber. Root chose not to reveal that it had been Taft who had initially delayed the Gardner report. Silent, stern, and loyal, he expressed no chagrin over Roosevelt's lack of sympathy. Solace was available in the form of a historic task in Havana. Under soothing fans in the Palacio del Gobernador, Root negotiated the final details of Cuban independence. The president remained oddly optimistic, although he had more reasons than Root to be gloomy. For the first time since his accession to power, he began to feel real opposition building up against him in Congress. Republican conservatives in the House had reacted contemptuously to an administration measure aimed at giving Cuba tariff reciprocity as a present for independence. Democratic senators were using Root's refusal to resign as an excuse to block passage of the Philippines' civil government bill. And on Wall Street, rumors that Attorney General Knox was going to proceed against the Beef Trust had strengthened corporate longings for a President Hanna. "Theodore is a total, abject, hopeless failure," Henry Adams reported with satisfaction. "He was always what we, in the language of praise, called a damn fool, and he has become a damn nuisance. At this rate, he will bring the government to a standstill in a year." If so, the members of his cabinet did not seem too worried. On 24 April, they invited him to join them on a stag cruise in celebration of John D. Long's retirement as Secretary of the Navy. Long himself acted as host aboard USS Dolphin. The little white yacht glided down the Potomac on the evening breeze. She gave off sounds of band music while a huge, air-filled dolphin swung at her masthead. When the boat returned after dinner, Long's guests were seen standing on deck in white tie and tails, drinking brandy and coffee under strings of colored lights. A Navy fiddler began to play bluegrass tunes. The president seized Philander Knox and began to dance. John Hay, tiny, dapper, and white-bearded, launched into a sedate two-step, while Leslie Shaw and Henry Payne shook down with Midwestern skill. At the climax of the reel, James Wilson, an awkward 6'3", disgraced the Department of Agriculture by falling down. Roosevelt's high-pitched laughter could be heard across the water. "Get up, you old cornstalk." His good cheer may have been helped by an awareness that the 57th Congress was dying, while his administration was becoming stronger and more Rooseveltian. The appointments of Shaw as Treasury Secretary and Clay Payne as Postmaster General had been political rather than ideological. Long's retirement, which he had accepted with regret but alacrity, gave him the opportunity to hire Representative William Henry Moody of Massachusetts, a 48-year-old expansionist and big Navy man who could be relied on to keep the flag flying over the Philippines. Spring came to the capital in an efflorescence of azaleas, dogwood, and magnolia, affecting even the dyspeptic Adams with a sense of rising sap and restless maternity. Newlywed couples strolled the mall. Washington now outranked Niagara as a sexual shrine, holding hands and asking directions in a rich variety of accents. The air grew daily warmer. Mockingbirds began to sing on the White House grounds. Roosevelt and his wife took to sitting on the south portico, talking of the things that had linked them since childhood. Flowers, poetry, the tales of Uncle Remus. They breathed the scents of the garden and watched the moon whitening the Washington Monument. An especial closeness linked them this season because Edith felt maternal pangs stirring within her. The president boasted to complete strangers that he expected a most important event in his household come October. Elihu Root returned from Cuba to find a virulent pamphlet making the rounds entitled "Secretary Root's Record, Marked Severities in Philippine Warfare." Published by the Anti-Imperialist League, it was more spiteful than accurate, and Roosevelt decided that the time had come for a counteroffensive. He summoned Henry Cabot Lodge and asked him to defend Root on the floor of the Senate. When Lodge rose to do so on 5 May, every seat in the chamber was taken. He began by admitting, with deep regret, that a number of American soldiers had tortured and killed Filipino guerrillas. No effort would be spared to bring the guilty to judgment. "But why," he asked rhetorically, "did these things happen?" He began to read an official catalogue of horrors that soon had his audience wincing. Some American prisoners of war had had their eyes slashed, their ears cut off, and their bowels hacked out. Others had been slow roasted, dismembered with axes, buried alive, and stoned to death. Drowning men had been used for target practice. Medics had been knifed in the back as they tended the wounded. Lodge could not bring himself to report publicly, as he did in private, that some captives had been castrated and gagged with their own testicles. "Perhaps," he drawled in his dry voice, "the action of the American soldier is not altogether without provocation." Over the next few days, a barrage of pro-administration statements, interviews, and editorials appeared in the Republican press. Reasonable voices were heard suggesting that the Army should be allowed to complete its current investigations, notably that of General Smith, before Elihu Root was held to further account. Groaningly, the big Philippines civil government bill began to move toward passage. It promised a legislative assembly, an independent judiciary, and an expanding array of civil rights. Senate Republicans closed ranks behind it. Only George F. Hoar of Massachusetts, stately, white-haired, Ciceronian, joined the Democratic opposition in calling for a declaration of total independence for the Filipinos. His eloquence was such that Roosevelt interrupted a Sunday walk to pluck at his toga. I sympathize with you, the president said, stuttering in his earnestness. I agree with you entirely, but how can I make any declaration just now? You respect Governor Taft, don't you? Hoar evaded the question, but, like Senator Hanna, could not help being beguiled by the questioner. Everybody that knows President Roosevelt knows his sincerity, he wrote the veteran anti-imperialist Carl Schurz. Roosevelt's desire to hold on to the Philippines, for strategic and idealistic reasons, did not affect his corresponding urge to let go of Cuba, the independence of which he and the Rough Riders had fought for in 1898. What better time to do so than now, and who more fitting to represent him at the transition ceremony than his old comrade, the military governor of the island, Brigadier General Leonard Wood? A few seconds before noon, on 20 May 1902, Wood clicked to attention in Havana's Palacio del Gobernador before an audience of local dignitaries. "Sirs," he read, "under the direction of the President of the United States, I now transfer to you as the duly elected representatives of the people of Cuba the government and control of the island." On the roof of the palace, Lieutenant Frank McCoy prepared for flagstaff duty. The Stars and Stripes hung above him, its folds barely heaving. Below, in the Plaza de Armas, a dense crowd sweated with anticipation. Thousands more Cubans jammed the adjoining streets, and every balcony, turret, and tree with a view. Even the harbor swarmed. Boats, heavy with spectators, jostled at anchor under a shimmer of bunting. "And I hereby declare the occupation of Cuba by the United States and by the military government of the island to be ended." Wood saluted President Tomas Estrada Palma and handed over the documents of transfer. From far across town, the Cayabas cannons boomed. Lieutenant McCoy remained at attention. He had to count 45 concatenations, one for every state of the Union, before he hauled down a flag that he would have preferred to keep flying. Both he and General Wood felt they were abandoning a saved people to perdition. By any standards, Wood's 2.5-year governorship had been a spectacular success. A trained surgeon, he had transformed Cuba from one of the world's most pestilential countries into one of its healthiest. He had achieved the miracle of eliminating Stegomyia fasciata. As a result, Cuba was free of yellow fever for the first time in almost 2 centuries. The miracle had not happened gently. Doors barred against Wood's sanitation teams had been smashed open. Hidalgos forced to pick up their own litter, and public defecators horsewhipped at the scene of the crime. Buildings in Havana and Santiago de Cuba had been purged with disinfectant so strong that, Even insects came out of the ground to die. But thanks to this draconian treatment, Havana was now a more sanitary city than Washington, D.C. The cannons continued to thud as the crowd grew restless. Cubans had mixed feelings about what was happening. The old Cuba Libre coalition, intellectuals, radicals, and peasants, welcomed the departure of the Yankees. Yet what Wood called the island's better class, businessmen, teachers, merchants, plantation owners, regretted the hasty withdrawal of funds and social services. Wood, after all, had built 3,000 new schools. He had paved Havana's dirt streets and transformed its parks from dangerous jungles into safe gardens. He had catacombed the city with new sewer systems, water mains, and conduits for power and communications. He had even protected the Cuban economy from exploitation by American entrepreneurs. What protection, the better class wanted to know, could President Palma guarantee? Who would teach in the new schools, and out of what textbooks? Who would buy the sugar sacks, already crowding every warehouse? The 45th cannon blast sounded. Lieutenant McCoy stepped to the flagstaff and undid the halyards. Old Glory seemed reluctant to descend. It sank a few feet, then the cord snagged, and it briefly rose. There were groans and catcalls in the plaza. McCoy pulled till the cloth tumbled about him. To thunderous cheers, General José Miguel Gómez, hero of the war against Spain, appeared on the roof to hoist the colors of Cuba Libre. But the cord snagged again, and Gómez asked for a lighter flag. It fluttered aloft, amid screams, tears, and ragged blasts of artillery. As soon as protocol permitted, General Wood bade President Estrada Palma farewell. He drove down to the harbor, escorted by troopers of the 7th Cavalry, and boarded the USS Brooklyn. The white cruiser weighed anchor at 4 o'clock. 100,000 pairs of eyes watched it steam north past the wreck of the Maine, upon which some grateful islander had tossed a chain of flowers. Chapter 7. Genius, Force, Originality. What's all this about Cuba and the Philippines? What's beet sugar? Theodore Roosevelt's total lack of inhibition, some said of decorum, was much discussed at Washington dinner tables in the spring of 1902. Whether exercising, working, or pricking the bubbles of solemnity around him, he seemed unconcerned by his growing reputation as the strangest creature the White House ever held. On 28 May, he was seen hanging from a cable over the Potomac, presumably in some effort to toughen his wrists. Owen Wister caught him walking behind John Hay on tiptoe, bowing like an obsequious Oriental. This might or might not have been connected with the fact that Roosevelt was currently studying jiu-jitsu. White House guardsmen, unaware that he was a published ornithologist, were puzzled by his habit of standing under trees, motionless, for long periods of time. Hikers in Rock Creek Park learned to take cover when he galloped by, revolver in hand. He had a habit of popping short-sightedly at twigs and stumps with live ammunition. Petitioners visiting the executive office learned to keep talking because the president usually had an open book on his desk and was quite capable of snatching it up when the conversation flagged. One day the French ambassador, Jules Cambon, found Roosevelt supine on the sofa, kicking his heels in the air. Cambon invited him to attend the dedication of an American monument to Comte de Rochambeau, whereupon Roosevelt, still kicking, yelled, "All right, Alice and I will go. Alice and I are toughs." On another occasion, he appeared in George Cortelyou's antechamber and jumped clean over a chair. He encouraged his big horse, Bleistein, to similar arts of levitation at the Chevy Chase Club. Photographs of them airborne together soon appeared in the Washington Times. Roosevelt was delighted. "Best pictures I've ever had taken," and passed out autographed copies to his cabinet. Hay, who as Secretary of State stood next in line to succeed Roosevelt, pretended to be annoyed at Bleistein's easy clearance of the rails. Nothing ever happens, he complained. Roosevelt might have said the same about the 57th Congress. Only one of the requests in his first annual message had been enacted, the establishment of a permanent census bureau. Senators Aldrich and Allison were maddeningly vague about what remained on the calendar. The president despaired of being able to affect them with any sense of social urgency. Friends took the brunt of his impatience. Get action, do things, be sane, he snapped at a former Rough Rider. Don't fritter away your time. Be somebody. Get action. Behind the harsh ejaculations lay anger at his failure to get action himself, in particular the Philippine Civil Government Bill, which he needed to show that the administration's colonial policy in the Far East was as enlightened as it had been in the Caribbean. It galled him that Senator Hoar was still calling for Philippine independence in tones of majestic condemnation. You have wasted 600 millions of treasure. You have sacrificed nearly 10,000 American lives, the flower of our youth. You have devastated provinces. You have slain uncounted thousands of the people you desire to benefit. I believe, nay, I know, that in general our officers are humane, but in some cases they have carried on your warfare with a mixture of American ingenuity and Castilian cruelty. Hoar was addressing himself to Republican imperialists generally, but the words you and your sounded uncomfortably specific as far as Roosevelt was concerned. At Arlington National Cemetery on Memorial Day, the president came to the defense of his Philippines policy. Oh, my comrades, he cried at grizzled ranks of Civil War veterans, the men in the uniform of the United States who have for the last 3 years patiently and uncomplainingly championed the American cause in the Philippine Islands are your younger brothers, your sons. They were fighting to impose orderly freedom upon a fragmented nation according to rules of just severity sanctioned by Abraham Lincoln. On Mindanao, as at Gettysburg, military power is used to secure peace, in order that it may itself be supplanted by the civil power. Roosevelt reminded his audience that legislation to that effect was now before Congress. There was scattered applause. We believe that we can rapidly teach the people of the Philippine Islands how to make good use of their freedom. The year's first hot sun beat down on bald heads and bright medals. A breeze came off the Potomac, stirring hundreds of flags up the hill and swaying the oaks over Roosevelt's head. Invisible choirs of 17-year cicadas buzzed in counterpoint to his voice. Perhaps Filipinos would govern themselves the next time locusts sang at Arlington. Perhaps not. When that day will come, Roosevelt shouted, it is not in human wisdom to foretell. For the time being, America's global interests mandated a continuing presence in Manila. The shadow of our destiny. He had been working on his speech for weeks, in an attempt to make it the first great oration of his presidency. But another shadow darkened his face, and he improvised a sudden, disastrous apologia for the recent military scandals. Is it only in the army in the Philippines that Americans sometimes commit deeds that cause all other Americans to regret? No, from time to time there occur in our country, to the deep and lasting shame of our people, lynchings carried on under circumstances of inhuman cruelty and barbarity, cruelty infinitely worse than any that has ever been committed by our troops in the Philippines, worse to the victims and far more brutalizing to those guilty of it. Had he spat upon the porch of the Custis Lee mansion, he could not have more effectively unified Democratic opposition to the Philippines bill. The ugly word lynchings, which he had so far avoided using in public, sounded deliberately provocative. I do not think the South will care much for Mr. Roosevelt after this, said an outraged Dixie senator. He is dead, so far as my section is concerned. Sure enough, when the bill came up for vote on 3 June, the Senate divided along party lines. The Republican majority prevailed, Senator Hoar alone dissenting, but Roosevelt took no credit for the vote. Neither could he console himself with Northern reaction to his outburst. Even the New York newspapers called it indiscreet, unfortunate, and in extremely bad taste. Bruised and rueful, he hoped for passage of his Cuban reciprocity bill as a sign that Congress was not totally hostile toward him. Another measure, however, had precedence in the legislative logjam. On Wednesday, 4 June, Senator Morgan called for the reading of House Resolution 3110. To provide for the construction of a canal connecting the waters of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Despite January's Canal Commission turnaround on Panama, Morgan was confident that the Nicaragua route would prevail. His own Committee on Interoceanic Canals had reported in favor of it, 7-4. Parliamentary rules required a reading of Senator Spooner's half-forgotten amendment to the resolution. Be it enacted, etc., that the President of the United States is hereby authorized to acquire, for and on behalf of the United States, at a cost not exceeding $40 million, the rights, concessions, grants of lands, etc., owned by the new Panama Canal Company of France. The President is hereby authorized to acquire a strip of land, the territory of the Republic of Colombia, 10 miles in width, extending from the Caribbean Sea to the Pacific Ocean, and to excavate, construct, and to perpetually maintain, operate, and protect thereon a canal of such depth and capacity as will afford convenient passage of ships of the greatest tonnage and draft now in use. Morgan laid down his copy of the amendment with an old man's tremor and made his final, weary plea for the Nicaragua route. He had no new technological arguments to present. Instead, he spent half an hour condemning Panama as a cesspool of racial and political squalor. He expressed Alabaman disgust for its low-grade population. Panamanians were not only unclean, but unstable. They lived, always had lived, in a chronic state of insurrection and violence against the authority of Bogota. Senator Hanna sat listening, the stillest man in the room. Morgan pointed out that the Treaty of New Granada, 1846, actually obligated the United States to hold Colombia together in exchange for railroad rights across the isthmus. A commitment was a commitment. Storming on, the withered little senator waxed prophetic. Should Washington show the least inclination to ignore the treaty, there is no doubt that Panama would eagerly seek protection under the folds of the flag of the United States. And should an American president be so rash as to extend that flag, it would poison the minds of the people against us in every Spanish-American republic in the Western Hemisphere. As soon as Morgan sat down, Hanna was on his feet. Mr. President, I desire to give notice that I will address the Senate tomorrow at 2 o'clock on the pending bill. When senators reconvened on 5 June, they were surprised to find the chamber festooned with maps and diagrams. One 20-foot projection, hanging from the visitors' gallery, showed red and black dots splotching Central America. The dots represented volcanoes, active and extinct. Those in red were lined up mainly with Nicaragua. Panama was dot-free. Hanna entered to a whirring of press telephones. Latecomers hurried to their seats as he sorted a mass of books and papers. He began to speak in his customary lackluster style. Mr. President, the question of transportation is one of the important items of the day. The chamber settled down to being informed rather than entertained. Not for Hanna the old-fashioned eloquence of Senator Hoar. He deemed it irrelevant to a new statistical century. Of his 88 listeners, 41 were for Nicaragua, 35 for Panama, and 12 undecided. Data, not dramatics, would get him the 10 further votes he needed. I was once, he admitted, in favor of the Nicaragua Canal. But after 2 years of reflection, I have been forced by stubborn facts and conditions to change my mind. For the next 1.5 hours, Hanna funneled his stubborn facts like wheat into the Senate granary. Every dry grain had its kernel of persuasion. The Panama route is 49 miles long, as against 183 miles of the Nicaragua. Trade winds blow every day in the year from 16 to 20 knots across the Nicaragua route. The annual cost of operating the Nicaragua Canal is $1,350,000, or say $1,300,000. "Oh, do make him sit down," came a woman's voice from the gallery. It was a cry of concern more than boredom. Hanna's arthritis was visibly tormenting him. He said that he would conclude his speech the next day. Polls in smoke-filled rooms that night indicated that the majority of senators favoring Nicaragua had already diminished. Cromwell and Philippe Bernot Varilla lobbied like men possessed, while Senator Morgan's lieutenants tried to fight attrition with scandal. They whispered that French shareholders of the Compagnie Nouvelle would not see a dime of the $40 million transfer fee, and that President Roosevelt, Secretary Hay, and Senator Spooner were the likely beneficiaries, along with Hanna, Cromwell, and Bernot Varilla. Even Princess Alice was rumored to be in on the deal. Hanna resumed his speech as soon as the Senate reopened for business on Friday, 6 June. Pointing to the splotched volcanic map, he said he wished to discuss the burning question of igneous activity in the Caribbean region. Just the previous month, Mont Pelee in Martinique had erupted, killing 40,000 people. Panama was exempt from this kind of danger. Not so Nicaragua, which lay along an almost continuously volcanic tract extending northwest from Costa Rica. Senator Morgan's canal would cut straight across that tract, probably the most violently eruptive of any in the Western Hemisphere. Mount Momotombo, 100 miles from the proposed route, had blown up only 2 months prior to Pelee. Had it done so with equal force, it would have precipitated enough cinders and lava to fill up the basin of Lake Managua. For another hour, Hanna cited alarming seismological, social, and navigational evidence against Nicaragua. Even as he spoke, Mont Pelee was erupting again. Reports of his speech in the evening newspapers jostled news of sky-darkening clouds and 6-foot fluctuations of sea level. As long as the canal debate lasted, the president kept his own counsel. Two senators visited him with learned arguments for Nicaragua, and he listened to them solemnly, scribbling on a notepad. Had they been able to look over his shoulder, they would have seen that he was merely doodling the names of his children over and over again. Meanwhile, his Cuban reciprocity bill was being lobbied to death. The House of Representatives had authorized him to grant a 20% tariff reduction on all Cuban exports to the United States, with the exception of refined sugar, which could come in free. But this last, seemingly generous provision guaranteed opposition in the upper chamber. Senators beholden to the American refining industry, mainly Easterners, mainly Democrats, objected to foreign favoritism, while senators from states that produced beet sugar, mainly Westerners, mainly Republicans, condemned the bill as anti-protectionist. "I wish," Roosevelt sighed, "that Cuba grew steel and glass." Common sense suggested that he leave trade policy to such experts as Nelson Aldrich, but his always active conscience, in this particular case of reciprocity, a moral question is concerned, plagued him, and morality aside, he believed that commercial sweets would reconcile Cubans to the sour taste of a United States garrison at Guantanamo. On 13 June, Roosevelt took the bold step of sending Congress a special message on Cuba. He did so knowing that the message could well fail, and advertised to the world that he had no power of presidential persuasion. It might even lead to a general tariff battle, a split party, and defeat for himself in 1904. His hope against hope was that the warring senators would be shamed into a compromise. "Cuba is a young republic," he wrote, "still weak, who owes to us her birth, whose future, whose very life, must depend on our attitude toward her. Some senators detected a note of self-identification in this appeal, and guffawed as it was read aloud. Meanwhile, sugar-heavy freighters wallowed in the island's ports, symbols of prosperity held in check. Some senators detected a note of self-identification in this appeal, and guffawed as it was read aloud. Meanwhile, sugar-heavy freighters wallowed in the island's ports, symbols of prosperity held in check. Another cause dear to Roosevelt's heart, reclamation of the arid West, was preoccupying the House that same day. He did not want to have a second special message laughed at, so he wrote a passionate letter to the chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. "My dear Mr. Cannon, I do not believe that I have ever before written to an individual legislator in favor of an individual bill, but I break through my rule to ask you as earnestly as I can not to oppose the National Reclamation Bill. Believe me, this is something of which I have made a careful study, and great and real though my deference is for your knowledge of legislation and for your attitude in stopping expense, yet I feel from my acquaintance with the Far West that it would be a genuine and rankling injustice for the Republican Party to kill this measure. I believe in it with all my heart, from any standpoint. Surely it is but simple justice for us to give the arid regions a measure of relief, the financial burden of which will be but trifling. I cannot too strongly express my feeling upon this matter. Faithfully yours, Theodore Roosevelt." Representative Joseph Not One Cent for Scenery Cannon was Congress's leading anti-conservationist. In Illinois, where he hailed from, well-watered corn thrust tall out of the nation's richest soil. But the president spoke for a harsher, more remote West, where recent settlers struggled to fertilize the desert. He had tasted enough alkali dust as a young rancher in the Badlands to understand the desperation of stockmen unable to breed, farmers unable to reap or sow. For a quarter of a century, environmental pioneers had urged the construction of vast irrigation systems to collect and distribute western floodwaters. John Wesley Powell and W. J. McGee noted that the arid lands thus reclaimed, one-third of the total area of the United States, could be sold to farmers and ranchers, and the profits recycled for further reclamation. But Congress had responded with unenforceable public land laws, allowing a water monopoly to grow up in the West. This combination levied extortionate rates where supply was meager and dried out established communities in order to irrigate speculative tracts elsewhere. Roosevelt expressed keen personal pride in the reclamation measure. It seemed to him properly to combine federal responsibility with private enterprise, in that water rights would be sold, deposit-free and interest-free, to small farmers, who would eventually repay the government out of the profits from their irrigated property. Although it was offered in the appropriate name of Francis G. Newlands, Democrat, Nevada, the president felt that it had grown out of the irrigation proposals of his first annual message, and he protested vehemently when Newlands claimed authorship. Cannon ignored Roosevelt's letter, but a majority of the House, responding to strong White House pressure, voted in favor of the bill. The Senate followed suit. On 17 June 1902, Roosevelt delightedly signed the National Reclamation Act into law. It funded a 600-man civil engineering force within the National Geological Survey and conjured up, like some glittering grail of future prosperity, a vision of dams and aqueducts bejeweling the country's unwatered tracts. "They must be built for permanence and safety," the president urged, "for they are to last and spread prosperity for centuries." Reclamationists spoke almost drunkenly of supporting a new population of 100 million and creating such opportunities for American producers as to make the current economy seem like penury. Mark Hanna praised the act as Theodore Roosevelt's first major legislative achievement and said that its importance would grow with the years. "People have not paid much attention to this business. It's a damn big thing." During the next 2 days, the senator, grumbling he was two-thirds crazy, he was so tired, launched a final blitz for Panama votes. Bernal Varilla conducted a simultaneous propaganda campaign, sending every senator a Nicaraguan postage stamp, showing the live cone of Momotombo. "An official witness," he typed beneath, "of the volcanic activity of the Isthmus of Nicaragua." Cromwell lobbied in his own secretive fashion. One by one, the 10 votes Hanna needed slipped from the Nicaragua checklist. When it was clear that Panama would prevail, the slippage became an avalanche. The final tally on 19 June was 67-6 in favor of a Panama Canal. By a margin of 44-34, the Senate also approved the Spooner Amendment. Theodore Roosevelt, 9 months President of the United States, was handed power to join the world's largest oceans. $40 million, the largest sum in real estate history, dwarfing the Louisiana Purchase, was placed at his disposal, plus $130 million in construction funds. Exultant, he forecast that the Panama Canal would be the great bit of work of my administration, and from the material and constructive standpoint, one of the greatest bits of work that the 20th century will see. Roosevelt's euphoria was short-lived, because 2 days later, a delegation of Republican leaders informed him that his special message on Cuba had failed. Hearteningly, though, Senators Aldrich, Platt, Hanna, Spooner, and Foraker had all backed him up. But the party's endemic inability to agree on tariff reciprocity had defeated even them. He had to take what comfort he could in widespread admiration for his goodwill toward Cuba and spectacular courage. Even the New York Evening Post, not usually complimentary, had called him a brave man and a real president. Somewhat cheered, Roosevelt left town on 24 June to accept an honorary degree from Harvard. Early next morning, the sun-tipped spires and elms of his alma mater appeared across the Charles. After a reunion breakfast in Back Bay with members of the class of 1880, he crossed Harvard Bridge in a plush carriage. He relaxed comfortably against its cushions in his white waistcoat, a porcelain club button at his breast, squinting at the bright water. Then the familiar elms of Cambridge dappled his silk hat, and bugle calls and cheers heralded his approach to Harvard Yard. Here, 25 years before, he had nursed the first great sorrow of his life. 24 years before, wheezed asthmatic over rhetoric and comparative anatomy. 23 years before, suffered agonies over a girl from Chestnut Hill. "As long as I live, I shall never forget how sweetly she looked and how prettily she greeted me." Grief, disease, desire, and now, even more privately, Edith's failure to carry her latest baby to term. Only the most masculine activism could dispel these feminine frailties. Roosevelt burst from his carriage like a bear. At the welcoming ceremony in Massachusetts Hall, he stood erect and talkative, his big chest nudging the presidential robes of Charles William Eliot. Outside in the yard, the class of 1902 was yelling for Teddy. Stimulated by the sound of cheers and press of flesh, Roosevelt began to radiate his famous electricity. He joined the commencement procession. Deputy Marshals Owen Wister and Woodbury Kane, 82, followed him. Wister: "When we were in college, you didn't used to like him much. How do you feel now?" Kane: "If he and I were crossing the Brooklyn Bridge and he ordered me to jump over, I'd do it without asking why." Roosevelt, calling: "What are you fellows dangling behind for? Come alongside." Wister, hurrying to catch up: "Unconditional surrender?" Kane: "Absolutely, old man." The president's behavior after receiving his honorary Doctor of Laws was so archetypal as to imprint itself on the eyes and ears of many observers. Dr. Eliot escorted him to a guest suite to change, and watched with fascination as he tore off his coat and vest and slammed a large pistol on the dresser. Eliot asked if it was his habit to carry firearms. "Yes, when I am going into public places." At the alumni banquet, Roosevelt spied Senator Hoar and plumped down beside him like an impulsive boy. He whispered a confession, saying it was his dearest wish to do what the senator wanted in the Philippines. Dr. Elliot began to speak, interrupting them. At the first mention of the word millions, so dear to university presidents, Roosevelt's attention wandered. Finance meant no more to him than the music of Chopin. He suppressed a yawn and swiveled in his seat, staring at pictures on the walls. When John D. Long introduced him with a joke about his inability to sit still in any position of power, Roosevelt shook from head to foot with laughter. Moments later, he was leaning over the high table at an angle of 30 degrees, his teeth still bared, but no longer in mirth. John Hay, seated nearby, knew what was coming. Harvard, to Theodore, was a temple defiled by mugwumps, who congregated here to exchange the dull coins of anti-imperialism. Sure enough, Roosevelt launched into a stentorian defense of his island administrations and of the public servants who sacrificed their careers to help weaker friends along the stony and difficult path of self-government. Clapping his hands for emphasis, he bit three names out of the air: Elihu Root, Will Taft, General Wood. Root could be earning fabulous fees as a corporate lawyer in New York, Taft could be a justice of the Supreme Court, and Wood, in a more mythologically inclined culture, would be celebrated as a hero mixed up with a sun god for the miracles he had performed in Cuba. Hay, listening, sensed a thought in many old heads. He is so young and will be with us for many a day to come. The president's forehead wriggled, his pince-nez flashed, and his harsh voice skipped from baritone to squeak, as pent-up loyalties poured out. With a final lunge across the linen, he roared, "I can show my appreciation in no way save the wholly insufficient one of standing up for them and their works, and that I do." He dropped back to his seat, drenched with sweat, and got a standing ovation. Hay marveled at his power to transform a skeptical audience. Even Dr. Elliot was moved. "He has genius, force, originality." Old Edward Everett Hale, who had attended more commencements than any man present, babbled that the president had made a speech to be remembered for centuries. Roosevelt had to attend 4 more functions and make 3 more speeches before he could retire to his private car. Pale with exhaustion, he vomited and went straight to bed. He was asleep before the train left Boston. Washington was shuddering up for the summer when he got back. Edith and the children had left for Oyster Bay. Even the White House was barred to him on account of extensive restoration and refurbishment by the architect Charles McKim. Carpenters were busy salvaging historic bits of floorboard, and plaster dust floated out of every window. It would not be habitable again until the fall. He took up temporary residence a few doors away, at 22 Jackson Place, and signed a last-minute stack of bills, none of them his. Legislation, Roosevelt realized, was not his forte. Public leadership was. Invitations were flooding in for him to address audiences in New England in August, in the Midwest in September, in the Far West, whenever he cared to come. He accepted them indiscriminately, even a grotesque summons from Los Angeles, singed across the shoulders of a calfskin. Congress adjourned on the first day of July. The Capitol drowsed into its annual doldrums. Hardly a hoofbeat disturbed the shimmering pavements, and cicadas hummed in Lafayette Square. Roosevelt, dressed in white from head to foot, had one final purgative duty to perform, a proclamation of amnesty in the Philippines. It had to be written around the fact that the Moros of Mindanao were not yet subjugated. They were fanatic Muslims and could be conveniently differentiated from other Filipinos. Elsewhere, Pax Americana ruled throughout the archipelago. In a lame attempt to equate civil government with independence, Roosevelt postdated the declaration July 4, 1902. Only then did he feel free to join his family on the shores of Long Island Sound. Chapter 8. The Good Old Summertime.
The capital of the nation has removed to Eyster Bay, a city on the north shore of Long Island, with a population of 3 million clams. Summer rain was falling as the Oyster Bay Special chugged out of Long Island City on 5 July 1902. New York's fringes progressively crumbled from wet factories to brickyards to sodden fields of flowers and vegetables. These in turn gave way to patches of marsh, hazy with insects. Presently, the land grew solid enough to support acre after acre of greenhouses, a farm or two, and some new towns, still edged with mud. Then white steeples began to prick the horizon, pikestaffs protecting the privileged greens of Nassau County, and the train swung northeast toward the Sound. Roosevelt had been riding this way for nearly 30 years, first as a teenager, lugging rifles, birdshot, and the smelly paraphernalia of taxidermy, now as a president, badly in need of a vacation. Familiar station signs flashed by in the drizzle: Roslyn Harbor, Seacliff, Glen Cove. The names had a marine ring, yet no hint of sea showed beyond wet roofs and foliage. The train curved eastward again, slowing almost to buggy speed as it descended Locust Valley. Forest closed in, broken only by an occasional duck pond or timber cut. Then the valley broadened, and light sliced through thinning trees. The rails leveled out, and suddenly the train was rolling along a little harbor, stiff with yachts. Were it not for the mild, salt-laden air, Oyster Bay might be mistaken for a lake. Green slopes surrounded it at all points of the compass, keeping out both the swell of the sea and the turbulence of the outside world. New York was not 30 miles away, but could have been 300. At the flattest part of the shoreline, a few sandy roads converged on a post office, an inn, 6 churches, and 10 or 12 squat commercial buildings. Members of the president's official party looked around anxiously for sources of entertainment. They saw only a library and an empty, dripping bandstand. "There are many one-horse towns on Long Island," a reporter noted, "but it is doubtful if there is another as uninteresting as Oyster Bay." The little community turned out in force to welcome its returning squire. Steam whistles shrilled the president's arrival, and thunder and lightning added extra dramatic effects. A new depot, not quite finished, sheltered Roosevelt as he descended from the train. Kermit, Ethel, and Archie, representing the family, flung themselves upon him, while his Secret Service escort made a wedge through the crowd. Grinning at the shouted familiarities of old-timers, here he was unavoidably Teddy, he climbed into an open surrey. Kermit joined the coachman, while the 2 younger children snuggled close to their father. He threw a protective oilcloth over them. Then, with a final wave at the crowd, he took what cover he could under his rapidly collapsing Panama hat. The surrey splashed east along Audrey Avenue, past the Oyster Bay Bank building, of which the first-floor office suite, 2 melancholy brown-painted rooms, had been reserved through September by George Cordeliu. Roosevelt had no desire to visit these headquarters. He intended to put as much distance as possible between himself and White House staff. His destination lay 3 miles farther on, beyond Christ Episcopal Church and Young's Cemetery, around the bend of Oyster Bay Cove. As the village fell away, Shore Road became an avenue of moss-hung locust trees, winding past the resorts of the rich, white-pillared cottages of 20 or 40 rooms, lawns sloping to sea level, beached rowboats bearing old names that spoke of power, breeding, and interbreeding: Tiffany, Beekman, Gracie, Roosevelt, Roosevelt, Roosevelt. Turning north, the surrey left the mainland and followed the line of Cove Neck as it jutted, rising into the bay. Reeds waved to the left of the road, and salt water slapped close to the horses' hooves, while on the other side the landscape became more rural, and fields and woods spaced out the mansions of Roosevelt's immediate neighbors. Ahead rose the crown of the peninsula. Its highest house was invisible for trees, trees he had planted himself in early manhood. Qui plantavit curabit. A private driveway led steeply up the slope, and Sagamore Hill disclosed itself at last, glowing dull red through the rain. Red brick below, red wood above, brown and yellow awnings over the west piazza, streaming shingles the color of old mustard. Roosevelt's eyes, rejoicing in the house's ugliness, noticed only one unfamiliar note, a telephone pole trailing wires back the way he had come. Evidently, Cortelyou was determined to keep him in touch with affairs of state. Rain gave way to sun in the days that followed. The hilltop breezes sweetened as catalpa and locust bloomed below, and the birds of Roosevelt's youth saluted his acute ear with remembered calls. Exulting in their clamor, he began to compose his first piece of presidential nature writing. Among Long Island singers, the wood thrushes are the sweetest. They nest right around our house, and also in the most open woods of oak, hickory, and chestnut, where their serene, leisurely songs ring through the leafy arches all day long. Chickadees wander everywhere. The wood pewees, red-eyed vireos, and black-and-white creepers keep to the tall timber, where the wary, thievish jays chatter, and the great-crested flycatchers flit and scream. In the early spring, when the woods are still bare, when the hen-hawks cry as they soar high in the upper air, and the flickers call and drum on the dead trees, the strong, plaintive note of the meadowlark is one of the most noticeable and most attractive sounds. On the other hand, the cooing of the mourning doves is most noticeable in the still, hot summer days. Oven birds fluted, too, in the heat, but more frequently after dark, when the whippoorwills were calling. Roosevelt spent many moonlit evenings on the piazza in his rocking chair, with Edith beside him, listening to this night-singing in the air. Despite his mature preoccupation with politics, he was still susceptible to poetic impressions. Musing on the behavior of screech owls, he produced one extraordinary, if ungrammatical, image. They come up to the house after dark and are fond of sitting in the elk antlers over the gable. When the moon is up, by changing one's position, the little owl appears in sharp outline against the bright disk, seated on his many times.